This is Making Conversation, the Australian Composers Podcast. In this episode, we're delighted to share an interview between David John Lang and South Australian-based composer Anne Corse.
So when do you find the time to compose, generally? Mm. When is your composing time?
Well, I should be doing some now, David, actually. But I had to put a hold on it to do this interview. No, no, I was actually doing something else as well.
Hello, and welcome to Making Conversation, the Australian Composers Podcast, bringing you the very best kind of procrastination. I'm David John Lang, and in this episode I'm speaking with Adelaide composer Anne Corse. Anne was in the middle of a bit of a creative block when I called round to her house in Prospect for this interview late last year. She had some unfinished songs sitting on the piano that she wanted to get her mind away from for a while, more on those later, and so I started by asking her, quite simply, where she was from.
I grew up in just outside of a small town called Freeling. It's about an hour north of Adelaide, about 15, 20 minutes north of Gawler. And if there's anyone listening who still doesn't know where that is, it's just outside the Barossa Valley. So that usually pinpoints it for most people.
Yes.
I grew up on a farm just outside of Freeling.
Okay, so your parents farmed?
Yes. Well, Dad still does farm, so it's mixed crop and pigs and used to have sheep. Yeah, all sorts of bits and pieces.
So where did the music come from then?
Not from Dad. although, as he will say, it was, you don't know for sure, he was just never given the opportunity. Mum had piano lessons growing up and could play, and I started having piano lessons at about age six or seven, thereabouts, and then continued, sort of took to it like a duck to water, really, and continued right through primary school, went on to high school, was very involved in music in high school, and picked up clarinet as well because I wanted to play in the band and I couldn't play in the band on piano. And yeah, just my sisters all learnt as well, so in the end we became quite a musical family, really.
But none of them did composition?
No, much more sensible than that. None of them went on to study music either. So both my younger sisters were, you know, more than proficient, but they all went up to about year 12 level and then went and got themselves real jobs.
So, so what was it that kept you doing music then?
What kept me doing music? You know, sometimes I look back and I do wonder what it was, you know, whether it was a specific feeling of you know, this is what I want to be when I grow up, or whether it was more, and I lean towards this more, that I couldn't really see myself at that, you know, fairly important stage of having to make a decision one way or the other, of doing anything else. It's always felt like a vocation, I suppose, in that it's something that I do, it's something that I enjoy. You know, I mean, even when I'm not enjoying it, I'm really enjoying it.
I understand.
You know, it's not always fun, but very rewarding and a lifelong sort of learning thing as well. You know, I don't.
You're never finished.
No, I'm never going to. Never going to finish.
Never
going to
retire then.
No. Oh, it sounds a bit sadistic, really, to find that appealing in a way that, you know, there's always more to learn. You're never going to have it done.
Yeah.
never going to
master it completely.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got to write the right piece. But, yeah, I suppose I finished year 12 and I wanted to learn more. I wanted to keep studying. And, you know, if I had a sliding doors moment and can go back, well, you know, maybe I might have decided to be a chiropractor or something. And I could possibly do that too. So, but, you know, this is the path I've taken. And so far it's, yeah. It's been interesting, rewarding.
So when did you first compose then?
I was a bit of a late starter. I didn't really compose anything properly until I was in year 12. Prior to that, I'd only sort of done fairly fairly creative arranging tasks, kind of like the class would have to do a 20-bar arrangement of a nursery rhyme or whatever, and I did a 40-bar arrangement of some song for orchestra. take the brief and kind of make it bigger than Ben-Hur, because I had enough musical knowledge, not necessarily about the instruments, but knew enough from my piano more than anything else, just about how the elements of music fit together to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And then, composed properly for the first time. Properly, I don't know if I looked back at it now. In year 12, and kind of went, oh, wow, this is really cool. I think I spent more time on my composing folio in year 12 than I did on every other subject. Yes. For the year.
And then so you went straight from there into going into the Elder Conservatorium?
Yes. So I auditioned. So at the end of my year 12 year, auditioned for the con on both piano performance and composing. I was accepted in for both. I had to decide what to do. It was a bit of a numbers game, really. I saw myself as being probably at the bottom of the pile of a large number of very, very good pianists, or one of a few doing composing.
Yeah.
And so opted for the latter. It did eventuate like that. I was one of two composers in my first year at the con.
Yeah.
And the other guy dropped out at the end of that year.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. So I was the only one.
So did you have much idea of what it would look like to be a composer?
No, I think I was very naive. And that's probably a good thing. So it wasn't that I was...
So you weren't worried?
Well, no, which seems really daft looking back now. And I'm not saying for a second...
Well, it's nice not to be worried.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying for a second that it's a particularly wise thing or that I would encourage anyone... beginning or partway through a composition degree to not think about it or not worry about it. I don't know, at some point worry only gets you so far. You either choose to do it and do it wholeheartedly, or you, if you're worrying yourself sick about it, then just get out and do something else. You can always come back to it. You can always do it part-time. You can always do it for the love of it, which, to be honest, in the current climate, many of us are having to do that anyway, so... it wasn't talked a lot about at uni. I hope it is talked about a little bit more.
Graham Kerner now likes to go on about the portfolio career.
The portfolio career, yes.
Idea.
Yes, which is true. And I suppose that is something that I learned for myself through experience very early on. So whilst I was studying composition, I was also teaching piano and clarinet. It's all connected. It's all, some more than others, but I do believe the teaching experience and having students has made me a better composer, has made me a better musician.
So you do much teaching now?
At the moment, not so much, other than at the con. So in previous years, I have done a lot. I think at the most I was teaching probably four and a half days a week in schools, so it just instrumental teaching. And then, so my son Oscar was, I had him 6 and a bit years ago, so after he was born I cut back.
We heard there the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Arvo Vollmer, playing an excerpt from a piece that Anne Cawes wrote in 2010. It was titled...
And There Was Light. Yes. Yep.
Which was just... Was that just after Oscar was born?
So I wrote it when I was pregnant with Oscar.
Yep.
And the premiere was... I think he was about 2 months old. So from memory, I was like 39 weeks pregnant when I was finishing up the parts or something. Or maybe he was just born and I was finished. I don't know. There was a lot of part editing with either a very big tummy or a newborn in a sling. One or the other. Almost the same thing, really. So that piece, at that stage, it was the largest musical commission that I'd received, so I was having to birth this orchestral piece and birth a child at the same time. So it made sense to me when I was deciding what I was going to write to have correlation between those two fairly significant events.
Would you compose, do you ever compose without a tangible outcome? Like you write a piece without knowing who's going to play it or who's going to hear it or anything like that?
Rarely. Rarely. And to be honest, the main reason for that over the last handful of years is because I've always had an outcome, which is an incredibly great, blessed position to be in as a composer. You know, some of those outcomes are, it's just a performance. Someone's saying, if you write something, we will play it.
Yeah.
You go, yeah, cool, that's great. But for me, as a composer, that's a really strong driver because otherwise we're just writing dots on a page and printing it off and heading down to Officeworks and binding it and looking at it going, oh, isn't that pretty, and then putting it on a shelf. our job's to communicate the ideas to the people who then make the music happen. For me, having the music happen is a fairly important part of the process.
So in that case, if nobody... ever heard your music, would you still write it?
I have to be honest and say I'm not sure. I hope so.
Why do you hope so?
I hope so. I think I'm a better person. I know I'm a better mother, better friend. When I am creating, yes, sometimes it just frustrates the crap out of me when I can't find the answer, fix the problem, finish the piece. But there's something inherent within me that does want, need to be working on something. And composing music is, well, for me now at the moment and into the foreseeable future is the thing that I work on. So yes, I hope I would. When do I find the time to compose? It varies very much. At the moment, because Oscar is in school, so on days when I'm not at uni teaching or have other commitments, whatever, I sort of have between 9 and 3 to get stuff done. And some days that works beautifully, and other days it gets to 12:30, 1 o'clock. You start thinking, oh, it's time for lunch, and then you're looking at the clock going, oh, crap, I'm going to have to pick him up soon. I have done nothing or I haven't gotten anywhere. On those days, usually nighttime. So after I've got him to bed and make myself a cup of tea and sort of chain myself to the piano for a few hours and hope that things will start happening so that I can feel like I'm getting somewhere. It comes in waves, really. There are some periods of time I can look back, like for this year, for instance, and think, my goodness, I can't believe I got all that done in that short space of time. And then there are weeks where sometimes even with the best of intentions, it doesn't happen. I mean, maybe that's just creativity. Maybe that's busy life. Maybe that's juggling. Juggling being a mum with working part-time with being a composer, all of those things. sort of intersect. Some weekends are great, some weekends are like, that's the last thing I feel like doing is sitting down and working on something.
So when you are composing then, are you always sitting at a piano?
Well, depends what you mean by composing, doesn't it? So I like to think, I hope, maybe more so than think, that there's a good deal that sort of happens in the subconscious when you're wandering around doing other things.
Yes.
Sometimes what I've found a fair bit in the last few years, actually, is when I'm driving, so listening to classic FM or other CDs or whatever, and picking up bits of pieces and needing to know, oh, what was that? Finding out the name of the piece and then tracking it down and listening again, and then, you know, one thing leads you to another, another, and then all of a sudden you've got this great idea, or this you've broken through that, you know, I've got no inspiration for this thing that I'm working on, and so you hear something, you go, oh, yes, that'll fix it. And
so it all still counts as composing time.
Well, hopefully, yeah. Except for if you're filling in a grant application. If you have to say, how many hours do you spend writing this piece? Well, how many coffee dates did I have with myself? Or wandering around the streets, reading through a text or singing through something in your head until you can kind of either convince yourself that what you've done isn't complete rubbish or find a better way of solving the problem. So in terms of where do I compose, like there's all of that stuff that happens, but then when it comes to actually putting dots on paper, for me, yes, the piano. It's a lot of sitting at the piano and then to-ing and fro-ing between the computer and the piano.
Yeah.
But I'm a bit old school. I'm a paper and pencil and piano girl when it comes to actually getting the dots down for the first time.
You used the word inspiration before, and most composers use it at some point, whether or not. By it is a different matter.
Yeah.
I asked Dan about this, and he doesn't like the word, I think.
Okay.
And I think a lot of composers come to not like the word because they get asked, you know, what's your inspiration?
Yeah, that's not a great question.
So that's not my question. My question is, do you believe in inspiration as a concept, and in what way?
Sometimes writing a piece of music feels like you've got this big, massive block of stone and you have to chip away at it over and over and over again, and you don't know what it is that you're making. You have faith that it will be something like what you... been asked to make or what your plan was or whatever, but there's a good deal of the unknown about how long it's going to take, what form it's going to be in at the end. I don't know, maybe that analogy doesn't really work because then I'm thinking about something that I'm struggling with at the moment, which I've rewritten the beginning of this piece dozens of times, and I can't crack it. So I suppose I've gotten my piece of marble out or my stone again and again and again, and every single time I sort of get to it and I go, no, that's not right. So coming back to this idea of inspiration, well, I guess there's something that's inspiring me. There's some goal that I know that I'm not getting to. So that's the composing that's not fun. And then I know I've had occasions where I sit down with probably the same amount of planning, the same amount of inspiration. I sit down at the piano and it just happens. And you write it down and there's minimal mucking around with it and editing, and it flows and it's easy. And yeah, I'm thinking of one piece in particular I wrote quite a while ago. There's been others as well, but this one, it's the closest that I'll probably ever get, I think, to writing something which I'm really quite proud of, which like maybe did it in an hour. It's like a 3-4 minute trio, and I don't think I'd change a thing about it. And it's frustrating that both of those processes, both of those The journey that is inspiration can exist, and you don't have control over which one. Here's another slightly different way of approaching it. I've been asked before about how I choose text, and the short answer is I don't know, other than when I read something that I know I can set, I know. And it's not even necessarily the topic, the theme of the text or the poetry. It's just I know that I can make music with those words. There is something inherently music within those words. And, yeah, there's an intuition there.
So something you can't explain.
Yeah. There's something very intuitive about just knowing, yes, I can be inspired by that. I drink to
that was The Last Toast, one of Anne Cawes's parting songs, which is the composition she was meant to be working on during our interview. It's a setting of poetry by Anna Akhmatova. Robert McFarlane was the tenor, Jamie Cock the pianist, and it was recorded by Ray Thomas. I asked Anne about the process of collaboration, something she is now very familiar with, having spent the last 3 years at work on an opera called Innocence, which is based on a book by Stephen Orr.
So it's myself and a director and a librettist who's also the producer, who's his idea, the whole project, and conductor, music director, all in a room once a month to review what I'd written in that month. So me bringing in, so this is all in piano score format, bringing in scores, so unfinished scores, bringing in, you know, crappy MIDI recordings from Sibelius, playing things through on the piano very badly, by the way, because I was always so ridiculously nervous about showing something incomplete. So it's, you know, ideas, you know, occasionally I might have had a complete scene, but even then there were often gaps in the middle, or, you know, you'd start and someone would say, oh, I'm not sure about that, and you'd go, oh no, well, if that doesn't work, then the rest of it's not going to work. And yeah, very, very confronting, being forced to show these incomplete, unfinished things I wasn't even certain of as well. Ideas to, you know, they're a small team, for them to listen to it once and go, oh, what about this? What about that? I don't like that. Oh, we shouldn't do that. Oh, by the way, I don't think we need this scene at all. And then have to go away every month and rewrite. There were a few months there where, you know, I'd come away and I'd go, okay, so in the last month I've written, let's say, 15 minutes of music. And of that 15 minutes of music, five of it now no longer exists in the opera because the text has been cut.
Yeah.
And of that remaining 10, half of that needs to be rewritten. Plus, next month, they want the next 15 minutes as well. So it's a very important process to go through for something of the scale that the opera is. And in learning so much over the last few years about the, at times, quite difficult balance between music, text and visual, so the acting, directing, movement aspect. Does the music tell the story, or do the lyrics tell the story, or does the action tell the story, or, you know, they all do, but it, who's the most important? And obviously, in this instance, you know, the libretto came first, but it's always malleable. And arguably, it's more malleable than the music, is.
Yeah,
there's certainly been times when, you know, the director will go, oh, we just need, really want to include, you know, these five words. You know, the music's great, don't change the music, but we need those five. Well, you know, obviously we have to change the music.
Yeah.
You know, we need this sentence in there. Can you make that work? And you go, oh, okay, I'll try. And, you know, just splicing things in the middle. It's really a really important process to go through for something large, because I don't believe it is all about the music. You know, I could write the best possible score ever for me, but if the text isn't right, and if the direction isn't right, and if the overall arc or dramatic shape of the story isn't right, then it doesn't matter if the music's fantastic. You know, everyone will go, oh, what was that about?
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't understand anything. What was that character in there for? So, but likewise, I don't want the music to be forgettable either. I go, oh, that was an awesome story. Yeah, hum me a tune. No, can't remember anything. So yes, working with people as a composer is challenging. We don't all speak the same language.
So do you see it as the opera, because it's basically, it exists now as a complete entity. Do you see it as something that is yours, or that you really just got a part of?
Yeah, that's a funny one, because, sorry, Adam, if you're listening, I do, a big part of me sees it as mine.
Yeah.
So Adam is the producer, librettist, partner in crime, I suppose. So it was his idea. He approached me about writing the music for the opera, and, you know, we had a workshop presentation a few months back. And so people who know Adam more than they know me were congratulating Adam on his opera. and not to take away at all from what he's brought to the project, or the fact that it wouldn't even be a project if he hadn't breathed life into it in the first place, and the hours and the work that he's put into it. But there is a big part of me that goes, it's my opera, because if there was no music, there would be no opera. but, oh, look, the lines get blurred, because in the end it becomes a, you know, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
Mm.
So the reason that the libretto works as well as it does is because of the relationship between it and the music.
Mm.
And the reason the music works as well as it does is because of how we see it, as well as how we hear it.
Yeah.
So, you know, all those element parts, and, you know, the costuming, and how evocative lighting can be, you know, just to pull at your heartstrings, and then to get that to line up with the music that's doing the same thing, hopefully with the libretto that's doing the same thing, and then with some decent actors / singers, you know, that's what creates the drama, and that's what creates the experience of opera. I'm humble enough to recognise I can't do that myself. But at the same time, yes, the score will have my name on it because I wrote the music.
Let's have a listen now to some of this opera, Innocence, with a libretto by Adam Goodburn and music by Anne Corse. This is a live recording from a workshop held in July 2016, and we'll be hearing Andrew George on the piano and Eleanor Brusted as Liz. who's in a state of bewilderment as she comes to terms with the disappearance of her children. Excerpt there from Act 2 of Innocence, an opera which is now in the later stages of its development, and we hope to hear much more of it in the near future. And that brings us to the end of this episode of Making Conversation. I'd like to thank Anne Kors for sharing her thoughts and her music with us. I hope you have enjoyed it as much as I have.
The Making Conversation podcast is brought to you by Making Waves. Making Waves is a free online listening resource, bringing listeners the latest new music from Australian composers. We'd love for you to discover, listen, like, subscribe, and share new Australian music. You can find us at makingwavesnewmusic.com. We'd like to thank all of the people who made this season possible. This includes the supporters of our crowdfunding campaign, Project Patron Cameron Lamb of Camaclang, and Creative Partnerships Australia's Match Funding Program. The series production team is Leah Blankendahl, Stephanie Eslake, Sasha Kelly, David John Lang, Matthew Lorenzen, Rebecca Aaron-Smith, Chris Williams, Antonia Zappia, Daniel Thorpe, Thomas Green, Lisa Cheney and Peggy Pelias, along with interns Angus Baxter, Marlena Radice and Mark Wolf. The podcast theme music was the work I/O by Australian composer Ellie Simic-Prozic. If you wish to learn more about the composer, music or interviewer featured in this episode, head to our website and click podcast to view the show notes. If you're enjoying these podcasts from Making Waves, there are a number of ways in which you can show your support, either by subscribing to this podcast via iTunes or your favourite app. You might even like to leave a review. You can also share this episode and the series with your networks. Making Waves is a voluntary endeavour. If you're interested in volunteering or interning with us, we'd love to hear from you. We also encourage you to consider making a small one-off or continuing donation to support the ongoing promotion of new Australian music and composers. Visit makingwavesnewmusic.com/support for more.